Well, it would be unkind of me if I didn't take just a moment to thank you for the invitation to come. I remember with a great deal of fondness our former study together a couple of Februarys ago. And I rejoice in your continued progress, your growth. If I had my way, I would sit down and let either Ben or Bill Hall or any of the men here that I think very highly of do the teaching, and then I would profit more than I'm going to. I want to ask you to do me the favor of listening with great scrutiny to everything I say. If I come out with something that is not true, I would count you a friend for letting me know that. But if you find that I'm in harmony with the Scripture, all I'm asking for is a fair hearing and a willingness to do whatever the Lord wants us to do. We're all in the same boat there. I have enough material this morning in the book of Joshua, which is where I'd like for you to turn, if you will. Enough material to cover about 6 weeks. I'll just pick out a few highlights here and there and hopefully end up in chapter 6, where I'd like to give a little bit of emphasis. In chapter 3 of Joshua, this will be in form more like a Bible class in the way it's presented rather than a typical sermon you might hear. Though there's quite a bit of overlap. Sometimes I don't know if I'm preaching or teaching. But in Joshua chapter 3, you see the children of Israel are crossing the Jordan River. In chapter 3, verse 10, the comment is made, "The Lord said, by this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that He will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites." They would know, they would have victory, they would conquer in the land because of what's going to happen in the Jordan River. And you'll see, this answers the question, who's the true and mighty God? Every one of these kingdom cities in Jericho had a god or gods that they thought was supreme. None of their gods could do anything. They couldn't see, they couldn't hear, they couldn't curse, they couldn't bless, they couldn't walk around on their own, they couldn't answer prayers. They had to carry them anywhere they had to go, and if they got knocked over, they'd have to set them back up. Their gods were a joke. The God of Israel had the power to lead the children of Israel across the Jordan. Now, they've gone to the place where the Jordan is, and they've stayed there for about 3 days before they cross. As they stay there, they look at this flooded Jordan River. And the Jordan River has flooded several times. I don't know if you can see that very well or not, but it's basically, many times it is flooded about a mile in width. People think the Jordan River was just this little small thing that didn't have much water in it. In fact, in some of the debates in the 1800s, some of the preachers who tried to teach that sprinkling is baptism, they would make the argument that a man could just take his foot and he could dam up the entire Jordan River. And J.D. Tent made an observation. He said, I've wanted to see the pyramids. I've wanted to see so many of the great natural wonders of the world. But he said, I'd give anything to see the size of that foot that could dam up the Jordan River. That would be a pretty big foot, wouldn't it? It had a plenty enough water to baptize a person in fact, to drown a person in. And it is a wonder that the whole nation of Israel didn't just drown. They just go in one right after another and they go on the other side. But the reason they didn't is because God's power is real. The God of Israel is real. When He leads them across, they're going to go across. And we won't take time to go into all the details of all this. You see in this particular slide, General Allenby's Bridge from World War I, this area was very much trodden over by the troops at that time. But when they go across that Jordan River and go to the other side, that answers the question, who has a right to this land in Canaan? If you go to the people of Jericho or Ai or Gibeon or any of the other cities there, they said, we have a right here. If the children of Israel had walked up to their cities and said, we want to live here, we want you to leave, they would say, well, we're not going to leave. It's only if Israel's God can conquer them and their gods that Israel has any right to the city. And before they can do that conquering, they have to enter into the land, which means they have to cross this flooded Jordan River, which is an impossibility, except we're dealing with God. As you look down again in verse 10, the Canaanites were very sinful people. Back in Genesis 15, God had made it very plain that the children of Israel would inherit this land. And the question here is not why he chose to destroy them, but really it's why he waited so long. Hundreds of years have passed, and now God says, your time is up, your iniquity is full, and it's time for the children of Israel to come in and to take your place. The issue is why he doesn't destroy all of us when you consider that. I know what I've deserved. I was a sinner, and without the grace of God, I wouldn't be alive and on earth today. I'd been sent to hell immediately. That's what I deserved. But God, in his long suffering, tolerated a lot of stuff out of these people in Canaan until finally he could tolerate no more. They reached that point where God said, now it is time for your destruction. And we're grateful that God is long-suffering, but the fact is, it does have a limit. When you consider the facts about this crossing, it tells us in verses 15 to 17 of chapter 3 that the waters stood in a heap. Verse 16 says they rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside Zaretan. So the waters that went down into the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, failed and were cut off, and the people crossed over opposite Jericho. Then the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel crossed over on dry ground until all the people had crossed completely over the Jordan. And it came to pass when all the people had completely crossed over the Jordan that the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, take these 12 stones, and they start building the monuments, two of them. Now, some people say this was not a miracle. They'll point to the fact that back in December 8, 1267, an earthquake occurred and it collapsed the banks of the Jordan up around about 16 miles. That's where Adam is, 16, 17, 18 miles north of where they would have crossed. Those banks came tumbling down, huge boulders, and they blocked the Jordan River, and of course it cut off the supply of the Jordan immediately. The water that had been there went ahead and flowed down to the Dead Sea, leaving a place where there was no water for quite a while. And they said, see, this is not a miracle. In July 11, 1927, another earthquake blocked the Jordan for 21 hours. And you can point to several other occasions. The thing about these natural occurrences is they didn't occur during the flood stage of the Jordan. During the spring of the year, after the snows have melted on Mount Hermon, to the north, those waters flow down, and you've seen in these pictures just what they can look like. Let me just say, incidentally, since 1948 or 9, that doesn't happen anymore because they've drained off so much of the Jordan for irrigation, both the Israelites and some of the Arabs there, that today the Jordan doesn't have as much water as it did. They're using it for irrigation. But they say, look at this. These are all natural occurrences, and we just wonder if that's not what happened here. Well, when you consider the facts, first of all, this was foretold and exactly fulfilled. He said, the priests will go up, they'll put their feet in the edge of the water, and immediately the water will stop. And that's what happened. How can you predict a natural occurrence? In addition to this, the timing was precise. What if they'd walked into it, and it was just a minor glitch, and then the water came and just washed them all away? Not only this, it happened when the Jordan was flooded. That hadn't happened before. Nobody crosses the Jordan when it's flooded unless they have some kind of very superior equipment or a helicopter or something of that nature. They had no helicopters. And then when you consider the water held for many hours, verse 16 shows us. Not only is that the case, the soft, wet river bottom became firm and dry immediately. That is not natural. Even if this had been the result merely of an earthquake and by accident, it just happened at the very moment when the priests put their feet up to the edge of the water, it just happened by coincidence to be that time. I grew up living on the Stones River. It ran right behind our house. I've seen the water in its flood stage, I've seen it when it recedes, and I know that when it recedes, it takes days for that muddy water to dry. Yet they walk over on dry land. The water has just now gone down, and they're walking over on dry land. It says it more than once. The water returned and started flowing again the very minute the priest left. What if some of the Israelites had fallen and had to take a few extra seconds to get up? They'd been washed away, wouldn't they? That didn't happen. In 2 Kings 2, just to illustrate the absurdity of thinking this is not a miracle, we have another occasion where the Jordan River yielded to a couple of prophets, Elijah and Elisha. This is Elijah's last day on earth. He's gone to various cities to visit the prophets before he's to be taken up. Elisha's with him. He doesn't want to see Elijah go. And we're told in verse 8, let's look at verse 8. Elijah took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water, and it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on, and here's your same expression, on dry ground. I wonder, at the moment he took his cloak and he struck that water, was there an earthquake that just happened to take place at that very moment by coincidence, let them walk over? And to walk over on dry ground again? And then in verse 9, when they'd gone over, Elijah and Elisha talk, and Elisha wants a double portion. The chariot comes and takes Elijah. And then in verse 13, Elisha takes up the mantle of Elijah. He went back and stood by the bank of the Jordan. Verse 14 says, he took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water and said, where is the God of Elijah? And when he also had struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. I wonder if there was a second earthquake. One at the time when they cross over that made it totally dry ground, and another at the precise moment when he's crossing back over the Jordan. That's harder to believe than the power of God working a miracle. And then in Joshua 4, verse 23, here is the use that is made of this. They're going to set up stones. More about that in just a second. But look at the use made of this event. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed over. The same word for passing over on dry ground occurs in Exodus 14, as occurs in 2 Kings 2 and Joshua 3. Same word. And so, what he's saying is there's an analogy here. Remember, the children of Israel kept the Passover and then fled Egypt. 40 years, almost to the day, after crossing the Red Sea, they crossed the Jordan River. He's using these two great bookends, the crossing of the Red Sea, the crossing of the Jordan River, in each case, showing who is the true God. This God who just absolutely decimated Egypt in Exodus 14 is now the same God who dries up the Jordan and who is about to decimate the kingdoms of Israel, the kingdoms of Canaan. So it's a very powerful case that he makes here. Joshua 3 gives us some lessons. You're to go in after the ark. The priests are carrying the ark. They go up and their feet touch the edge of the water and the water stops immediately. You follow the ark. You don't go before it as though you're leading. A lot of people want to lead God. Whoever goes onward and doesn't abide in the doctrine of Christ doesn't have God. It's not our purpose to lead God. It's His to lead us. They don't walk beside it as though they're equals. They don't walk anywhere except behind it, and then at a large space, almost half a mile back from it. It would make it easier to see at that distance, and it would also mean they're not to get too close. God is telling them, you come with me, but don't get too close because my holiness would destroy you. Very similar to the lesson of Exodus 19. Don't get too close to this mountain because you won't survive. And so you see here, on this occasion, he's giving them a guide to follow. It's God, represented by this ark, God who is in the midst of this Jordan causing it to behave as it does. It's not just a coincidence. The priests bear the ark. David would learn this lesson the hard way many years later, that it's the priests who are to carry the ark. And the purpose in these procedures in Joshua 3, verse 4, that you may know which way to go. Well, that's the lesson we all have. We have to follow God to know which way to go. Jeremiah 10, 23, it is not a man who walks to direct his own steps, is it? We follow God just as these people had to follow the ark. Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And he says, you've not passed his way before. That makes a very good sermon in January of each year to say, you have a blank sheet. Here's a new year. You've not defiled it in any way. You've never walked this way before, but if you follow God, you'll do well. If you don't, you'll fail. But it's more than that. Here's a whole new life for the children of Israel. They've been slaves. They've wandered in the wilderness. Now they have their own land that God has blessed them with in such abundance. Also, he says, don't just do something, stand there. We typically reverse that today and say, don't just stand there, do something. But here, don't just do something, stand there. You wait on God. Ephesians 6 tells us, having done all, to stand. Their GPS, their global positioning system, is the word of the Lord. If any man speak, let him speak as the oracles of God. Back then, what God said, they would listen, they would do. They would know that they could inherit the land. We could know that Jesus is what he claims to be, Luke 1, 4. God deals with verities, with facts, not with suppositions or possibilities. The only possibility is what we will do with the facts he gives us. And then the effects of the great miracle crossing the flooded Jordan, it extolled God. Israel would know, Canaan would know, and all those folks heard about it. Rahab has already told the spies, our hearts melted. When we heard what happened in Egypt, we heard about God, what he did with the Red Sea. We heard how he destroyed the greatest nation on earth. And now this God who's destroyed the Amalekites, Sihon, Og, Arad, Numbers 21. Now he's come here, and he's aiming at us. She knew what was about to happen. She cast her lot with the children of Israel. She's a very remarkable woman who had more insight into things than many of the children of Israel had in the book of Numbers. It not only extolled God, it exalted Joshua. Four times in Joshua 1, be strong and of good courage. God says it to him. Moses says it to him. The children of Israel say it to him. They need this man who will follow God. Throughout Israel's history, when leaders followed God, they prospered. When leaders thought they were the men, they were worthy of being followed, it caused Israel to fail. And then it encouraged Israel tremendously. Look at the God we serve. He can stop a flooded river. Joshua had seen the Red Sea part. Not all the children of Israel had. The new generation had replaced the old one. There would still be some around who had seen the Red Sea, but for those who had not, here's something just as miraculous, just as impressive. And then it enfeebled the nations. These nations are scared out of their wits. Can you blame them? What power do they have against the God who can do these things? Now, the 12 stones set up, that proves that Canaan was God's idea. Back then, they wondered, now, who has a right to this land? You notice that that discussion still goes on today? There's still turmoil and fighting over who has the right to this land? Well, today, God hasn't said that Israel has this right. They've forfeited any right they have. As far as a political ally, I would favor Israel. But I can't point to the Bible and say that's exactly what God told needs to be done. There was a time when that was the case, and that's the book of Joshua. God said, these are the people, they deserve the land. God is the source of their victory. The promise of God must be fulfilled. He's promised it in Genesis 15. God never lies. And it preserves the memory of what God did. So they would set up these 12 stones. They would go in. The priest's feet touch the edge of the water. Then I get the impression from reading chapter 4, they walk on into the middle where the water was at its greatest when it was flowing. They stand there. The children of Israel pass through. And there where their feet stand, these 12 men are to pick up 12 big stones. And they're to take them on the other side and set them up at Gilgal as a memorial. Gilgal, some 7 or 8 miles from the Jordan where they would first camp. Just 2 miles away from Jericho. And every time they would walk by and see these 12 stones set up, it would remind them of what God had done. They needed constant reminders. And so do we. We have reminders. We have the Lord's Supper as a reminder of what our God has done for us. We have the first day of the week itself. A baptism itself serves as a reminder, a memorial for us. Now, the priests enter, the armed men of the 2.5 tribes cross over before the others. One of the words that's used early in chapters 1 and 2 and 3 is that these children of Israel who have decided to stay on the east side of the Jordan, Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. Reuben, Gad, half Manasseh. That these tribes would form the vanguard. And it uses a word there that means five parts as they would go through. So I would assume it's something like this. They form the vanguard. Here are the 2.5 tribes who are at the very front of the battle. Their land's been conquered. They're going to show their sincerity by being right in the front of the battle when they go to conquer Israel. Then you have the main body. You have a wing on the left, a wing on the right. Then you have a rear guard. That's five parts. Now, as you look at this, the priests leave the riverbed. Everybody's crossed over. God says, now you get out. They get out. As soon as their feet leave that area, then the river returns to its previous flood stage. What that means is there's no turning back at this point. Herodotus, the great historian, some 400 years before Christ, tells us that there was an occasion when some of the Greeks, when they were fighting against the Persians, against Darius, they placed themselves in front of the Meander River. And they said the reason for doing this is if what we have in the way of bravery by nature tends to fail us, this river will reinforce. We have no place to go. That's why the children of Israel is here. Before they cross the Jordan, they can turn back. They can go anywhere they want to, and they're safe. Once they cross that Jordan and those waters start to flood again, if Jericho comes to attack them, if Ai comes to attack, if all of them gang up together and come to attack, if they don't have the help of God, they're going to be destroyed. They have no place to run. The Jordan River is at their back. But now, with God on their side, it's His way of saying, yes, the Jordan's there, but they're the ones who are scared, not you, because you have me and they don't. That's a great lesson that we need to remember. Also, the spring rains, April through May, the melting snow caused the Jordan to flood. Normally, the Jordan River is about 80 to 100 feet, especially at that time. Often, it's 1 mile wide in its flood stage. So you have two memorials set up in chapter 4. And I won't have time to elaborate on this, but the priest's feet touch the water. They take their stones, they set them up at the place called Gilgal, their first camp, as they cross over. And then you have some other stones at the standing place of the priest. 12 other men take 12 other stones and set them up inside the Jordan River itself, right in the middle of it. And it would be possible then, when the Jordan River is at its normal flow, they would be able to stand on the bank on either side and look and see those 12 stones that are covered partly by the Jordan River and see, there's where the priest's feet stood. Imagine a little boy saying, Father, how did this occur? And he says, well, you see those stones right there? Those stones were put up to remind us of the power of our God who led us across this flooded Jordan River to bring us into this land to conquer our enemies. Here is a place where they'd been camped, Shittim, Abel Shittim, or Acacia Grove is what that means. They cross the Jordan, they go over here to Gilgal, which is 2 miles from Jericho. Now, he says, remember the river. Several things about this deserve our attention. Number one, remember the river is a call to teach future generations. As long as the children of Israel continued to teach the future generations, they were strong. They held fast to the truth. They were blessed by God Almighty. But sadly, if you look at the first chapter of Judges, first two chapters, the next generation largely forgot to teach that next generation and they fell away. They turned to other gods. It is incredible. It is absolutely incredible how they knew what this God had done for them. They knew the power He had was like none other. Nobody had such power. And yet they turned from the one true living God to serve idols. It is incredible. The only explanation I know for it is because these idols they turned to offered them all kinds of licentious, immoral, ungodly pleasure that were forbidden by God, that God would have protected them from the things that these idols offered. Number two, remembering the river is a commendation of the one true God for the benefit of the people. Look what our God has done for us. We need to live in a state of constant gratitude to our God for what He's done for us. If giving the children of Israel the land was something to be thankful for, and it was, He gave us His Son. How grateful ought we to be for the wonderful blessings He's provided for us. It's a challenge for the Canaanites. If their hearts have melted because of the defeat of these nations and the passing of the Red Sea, what are they going to say about the crossing of the Jordan? Now they're here among us. They have successfully crossed over. They're on our side of the Jordan. And we know what comes next. No wonder Jericho is totally shut up in its defensive mechanism in some small effort to try to thwart their efforts to destroy them. And then it provides courage for the children of Israel. The children of Israel need not be afraid because God is on their side. I look at that and I see the world we live in today. There are a lot of things that seem terrifying to children of God. We wonder, what's it going to be like? We think about the Supreme Court. We think about who's president. We think about the morals in our country. We wonder if our young people will make it. One thing I know, if we continue to rely upon God, we can have courage. All will turn out well. And at the moment we forsake God, we don't have any right for courage. We might as well be just as afraid as people of the world. And then that brings us to this. If human wisdom were in charge, then God made a mess of things. A total mess. Human wisdom would say, no, as soon as you cross over, you camped at Gilgal, prepare defensive fortifications. After all, Jericho may attack us. We have to be prepared. God doesn't say do that. We need to strike the enemy while their morale is low. So let's just go right now. God didn't have them do that at all. They wait. And then they could even offer surrender terms. You know, with people this scared, maybe like Rahab, they'll say, we want to be one of you. And all the people would come and then they would mix with them and become like them, which is what happened in some degree. That's not what God does at all. That's human wisdom. Divine wisdom says, first of all, you men need to be circumcised. Now, you may recall in Genesis 34 the occasion where one of the cities in Palestine, Shechem, there was a young prince there who took a liking to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. And he takes her. And he defiles her. And when he comes and he asks for permission to marry her because he is so in love with her, the sons of Israel speak with deception. And they said, well, we would be glad to do this, except we can't have anything to do with people who aren't circumcised. But if all of you men are circumcised, then we can agree to this arrangement. So they go back and they tell their people, look, these people have a great number of animals. They're rich. We can get a lot of their property and trade with them and have a lot of good things, but we're going to have to be circumcised. That took place. On about the third day, Simeon and Levi go in and they absolutely decimate every person in that city. Absolutely decimate them. They were helpless. Why in the world would God's first prescription for the children of Israel after they crossed the Jordan, why would His first prescription be, now, you men need to be circumcised. Does He not know how vulnerable that will make them to their enemies? Does He not remember what happened to Shechem? Well, there's this difference. This is the God who stopped the Jordan River. This is the God who gave them the Passover. I know they kept the Passover just before they leave Egypt. I know in Numbers 9 they partake of it again. And then I don't see them doing that again anytime in the book of Numbers. This appears to be the third time. And it seems that their unbelief prevented them from being able to take the Passover in the wilderness. Oh, whatever view you take of that, there's another preparation. Now, that wouldn't have been the way we would prepare for war, would it? But it's God's way. God is telling them, your only strength is in me. It's not in your military might. So if you're not part of my covenant by being circumcised, that's the first order of business. And if you haven't kept Passover at the proper time, like we need to now, then I cannot have anything to do with you. You'll be cut off instead of cutting them off. And then third, now you have to find food for yourself. He's been sending the manna, but as soon as they're in the land, they have to provide that for themselves. God never does for a person what the person can do for himself. Why should He? That would not be productive for us. The true general here is God. I'm sorry to have to go through this so quickly, but the clock is not my friend. The three events here, the circumcision, the Passover, and the produce, were for Israel's benefit. It was a way of saying, Israel, you need to trust in God, even though it doesn't look like the smartest way to do things according to man's wisdom. And that's 1 Corinthians 1. What God tells people today is not according to man's wisdom, it's according to the truth of the gospel. But this event is for Joshua. Joshua's standing there in chapter 5. And even leaders need encouragement. We see that in chapter 1. But in chapter 5, verse 13, it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man. Your versions may have a capital M on the man there, as mine does. Stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand, and Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or for our adversaries? Now, Joshua hadn't given a command for someone to draw a sword. He's waiting on God to give that order, and that hasn't happened. Here's a man with a sword. So he said, no, but as commander of the army of Israel, I've now come. Well, Joshua was the commander, wasn't he? No, not really. This one is the commander of Israel. Joshua is merely his captain. So he said, I've come as the commander of the army. Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshiped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? Joshua immediately recognizes there's more going on here than meets the eye. Then the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. Then the narrative tells us in verse 6, Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out, none came in. And the Lord said to Joshua, verse 2, I believe is picking up where chapter 5:15 left off. If it's not, then he just shows up. The commander just shows up and then gives no instructions to Joshua at all. Joshua is by Jericho. Deuteronomy 1, verse 28, tells us something about what these cities look like. And in so doing, it says, where can we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts, saying, the people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. I imagine Joshua standing there. He's 2 miles away. You can easily see Jericho from that distance. It's a huge, huge place. Huge walls. And I don't think Joshua doubted for a second that God could do it. He's seen the Red Sea. He has seen God's provision for them in the wilderness. He's seen the Jordan River dry up. He knows God can do this. But if he were to look at it merely from a human perspective, he would be saying, how in the world are we going to take those fortifications? Joshua, for example, never led an attack against a city. He was always out in the open ground. Joshua knows that Jericho is prepared for a long siege. They already shut up. The harvest has been brought in. They can stay in there a long time before we can break down these walls. Israel has no siege engines. They weren't equipped to carry out a siege or to break down walls with rams and catapults and helepolis and other things. It's a steep, smooth, plastered scarp, slanted slope that goes from the first wall of Jericho up to the second wall. They couldn't even plant any of these siege engines up there without sliding and then having the people shoot arrows and rocks down on them. How is he going to do it? Jericho has to be defeated. They can't pass by it. Their camp is just 2 miles from Jericho. If they go out and conquer somebody 20 miles away, Jericho can sweep in and take all their goods, kill the women and children. It has to be dealt with. And he's looking at that, and from a human perspective, how can it be done? Oh, but there's God. He's the commander. This man stood before him, as was the case with Abraham and Jacob and Moses. Joshua's in the presence of God. Take the shoes off your feet. It was reminiscent of Exodus 3. This is the commander of the army. The Lord, Joshua falls on his face and bows down. He asks, what does my Lord say to his servant? He immediately recognizes his inferiority to this true commander. Take your sandal off your feet. The Lord spoke to Joshua. And you see other passages on that. Now, in Joshua, by conquering Jericho and Ai, Israel gains access to this hill country. It drives a wedge between the north and the south. Though Jericho is fortified, victory assured. God says to them in verse 2, I have given. He uses a prophetic perfect here that says it's as good as done. I have given. You still have to go take it, but I've already done the work. The deed is done. As the ark held back the Jordan, now it's going to bring down the walls. Remember, they're going to march around the city with the ark. That same ark that held the Jordan is going to take down these walls. This is the most unusual battle plan you ever saw. It's not one with ordinary weapons. He didn't say, now make sure your swords are really sharp and your spears are really long. No, it's really strange things. You march and you shout. That's not the way man would have done this. The battle plan seems flawed. What prevents Jericho from shooting arrows and throwing rocks at them as they march around? This battle plan's on such a high level, no man would have thought of it. Our scheme of redemption is that same way. No man could have thought of it. And providence He takes care of them. Joshua doesn't argue. The word seven. You'll notice it's seven priests. They carry seven trumpets. They do it for 7 days. On the seventh day, they march around Jericho seven times. What general plans to defeat a city based on the number seven? Seven is my favorite number, so let's see if we have seven troops here and seven companies here. Nobody does that, but God does. This is a picture of Jericho as it looks today. A huge, huge mound that remains. This is looking at it, looking south. There's a road now over to the right of it they've made after some of the excavations. This is a pretty good picture of what Jericho would have looked like. It's very similar to what it would have looked like at the time that we're discussing here. It had this outer wall with this inner wall, and it had cities, it had houses that were built inside these. In fact, concerning Rahab's house in chapter 2, it says her house was, the little preposition it uses can mean in or on. If you say you're building onto your house, that doesn't mean you have to go up. It can mean out this way. Her house is on the wall, meaning that here's the first wall, here's the second wall. They have houses in between, and her house butts up against this so that they can just slide down over that back wall of her house, which is also the second wall of the city. Jericho, oldest city on earth, maybe. It's around 750 feet below sea level. It was abandoned for centuries until Hiel the Bethelite rebuilds it in 1 Kings 16. He loses his first son at the setting up of the foundation, another son at the setting up of the gates. And I think he was so ignorant of what God had done in cursing the city, he just thought, oh, what bad luck I've had. He didn't realize there was a curse attached to the rebuilding of this city. Their excavations, the German crew of Selin and Watzinger in 1907, 1908, 1911, 1909, and so on, they did very good work, but didn't know as much of the modern methods as others. And John Garstang, a very famous, very capable British archaeologist, came in 1930 to 1936. He made one mistake in dating one of the walls as though it were in this period, but other than that, he found a number of items that he said are very consistent with this period. He dated this at 1406 B.C. Then he wanted Kathleen Kenyon to review his work. Now, Kathleen Kenyon was the daughter of a very famous Bible student and curator of the British Museum by the name of Sir Frederick Kenyon. I have a great deal of respect for Sir Frederick Kenyon. Both he and his daughter were members of the Anglican Church, the Church of England. He had a great deal of respect for the Bible. He's written a number of things showing the integrity of the New Testament is real, is what it claims to be. But she was not much of a believer. She was just sort of on the fringe of any kind of faith. And when she went and examined it and reviewed the work of John Garstang, she said, there was no city there when Joshua entered this place. The city of Jericho is fiction. It did not exist. It was 150 years earlier. Joshua wasn't even born when these walls were here. Well, that shook up the world. Believe it or not, that's what biblical archaeologists wanted. I've seen archaeologists interviewed, and they'll say, oh, is this the wall that was here when Joshua marched in? They say, well, there was no city here when Joshua came. Of course, the effects of that is they will do their biblical archaeology. But they will do it with the purpose of trying to tear down as much as they can. They'll tear down Joshua's walls in an evidential sense. They didn't exist. If you look even at conservative dictionaries that are a few years old, the Nelsons, the Zondervan, they will show that we just don't have any evidence at all for this city being here at the time the Bible says Joshua came through. Now, the reality of that is, it just means we wouldn't have that evidence. It didn't mean it wouldn't occur. Just like the children of Israel walk on the sands in the wilderness, we don't have their footprints on those sands. We don't have to. We know the children of Israel went into Egypt. We know they came out of Egypt and went into the promised land. We know these things occurred. But just be aware of the fact, this is what archaeologists wanted when Kathleen Kenyon made her conclusions. They have found that the city of Jericho was surrounded by an embankment and a stone retaining wall at the base, some 6 to 12, 15 feet all the way around. Here's the retaining wall. You see, not very well, but images of little people that have been drawn here just to show you the size of this first wall. It's absolutely impregnable. And then you have this scarp we talked about, this slope, and then the second wall up here. On top of it, this mud brick wall, 6 by 20 to 26 feet high. That would be this one here on top of this retaining wall. Within the upper wall, about 6 acres, the city. And since 1907 and 1909, we've known that there were houses built, Rahab's among them, up in this area between these two walls. We know there's a spring inside Jericho that would provide them with water. They've just brought in the harvest, so they have all the food they want. They can withstand a very long siege. They have water supply, so they're not going to get thirsty. They have huge walls that nobody can conquer. So from the human perspective, this city never should have fallen. Harvest has just been gathered, Joshua 3, verse 15. This shows just more of what we've seen. This shows some of the measurements. Now, one of the good things Kathleen Kenyon did, this is that retaining wall, this part in black right here. She said that when she got on the, I think it was the west side of the wall, she dug a little deeper than ordinarily had been the case. What she found was, she said, a number of these red bricks. And she said they must have fallen from the top of a retaining wall, or maybe even from the top of the second wall, or maybe both. And the effect of these falling bricks was, when they came down, they cascaded in this way. And you notice, these men who are just by their own height, about this high, now can climb on these, and it's just like an ancient escalator leading them right up into the land. It provided them a way, get this, so that each man can go straight up into the city. The destruction of the city has already occurred when the walls collapse. The people are addled. You know how people are, say, if there had been an earthquake or something, how people are, they're not prepared to fight. The children of Israel walk right in to destroy all of them except Rahab and her family. And it's interesting to note that as they looked at these walls, as far as they've dug so far, there was one little part of the wall that did not fall. And that's the part where Rahab's house would have been. And I've seen pictures of this. I can't pick out which house hers was because I couldn't see her name on a mailbox anywhere. But it was surely one of those that has been left. Now, as you look at this little diagram of what was taking place, here's a little picture of the second wall, the first wall, and here's an illustration of the red bricks that had fallen where they can just climb up and rescue her and destroy the rest of them. Garstang said, now this took place in 1406, very accurate dating. Kenyon said, well, no, it fell in the mid-16th century, 1550 B.C., long before the late Bronze Age. So, the conclusion she drew, there was no strongly fortified city at Jericho for Joshua to conquer. These conclusions contradict the Bible, so it must be false. Ah, that's what you'll hear a lot, isn't it? And then third, if Jericho is wrong, throw out the whole book of Joshua. All of it's wrong. Now, the interim conclusion for us is this. I remember in the 70s reading an archaeology book by a man named Ian Wilson, a very excellent Australian archaeologist who's a very strong believer that the Bible is the Word of God. And he said, concerning Jericho, he said, we just don't have any evidence left to us. Erosion happens, fire happens, all kinds of things. So we don't have to have that to believe what God said in His Word. And that is absolutely true. And that's the best they could do. Until finally, a man by the name of Bryant Wood started noticing that some of the evidence that had been presented to Kathleen Kenyon, she had totally ignored, namely the pottery. So, pottery doesn't lie. There's very little writing in Palestine during the time that Jericho fell, but there was a lot of pottery, and pottery always tells the truth. Kenyon was selective in her examination of the pottery. She was looking for Minoan Cypriot pottery and didn't find any. Strangely, she didn't look in the places where she should. She dug in the lower class sections of the city where they wouldn't have had many expensive things instead of in the other places. Many biblical scholars use archaeology to bolster views which they'd already come to hold independently of the archaeological evidence. And that is the case. Bryant Wood had been a mechanical engineer for several years, and he went back to school, got his PhD in Syrio-Palestinian archaeology with an emphasis on pottery. He knew pottery very well. Now, he showed that what Garstang said was right. Garstang had given much of his pottery to schools that had supported him. Bryant Wood went all over the world and studied in these libraries and looked at every single piece of pottery and showed that it was the kind of pottery that existed at the time, traditionally, Jericho was said to have been destroyed, 1406, for example. The late Bronze Age pottery, the concentric circles on the inside of it. And Kenyon ignored those. If she hadn't, then it would have been a different story. So she looked at those. We know that Jericho was very fortified. We know that an attack occurred just after harvest in spring. We know that because of the flax she's drying out. So some part of her house was exposed to the open air so the flax could dry. We know the flooding that took place in 315. That's the spring of the year. We know the Passover was in the same period of the year. We know the most abundant item found in Jericho, besides the pottery, was the grain. They found a lot of pottery, but they found all these grain bins, and they hadn't been touched. They were filled to the brim. Now, a city that has been sieged will eventually get into their food supply. They didn't do that. The food supply was still there. If you're sieged for 7 days, you don't break into the food supply. So it's a very short siege. They had an opportunity to flee with the food. It was a short siege. The grain was not consumed, but burned. The walls collapsed, and even Kenyon admitted the walls collapsed before they were burned, as the biblical narrative tells us. The city was not plundered. They found full jars of this grain. Grain was a commodity in the ancient world, very expensive. One of the first things an enemy would capture was the grain. The city was burned. The evidence shows that this took place in the late Bronze Age. We would say 1400 to 1200 B.C., and then that gets into the idea of what it means to be accursed. That's why the city wasn't taken. 5 times in chapter 6, verses 17 and 18, that word accursed occurs. It's something devoted to the Lord, either as being destroyed or as being set apart to sacred uses. And various passages speak of that. I think our time's probably gone, isn't it? It's 10 till. But anyway, I thank you very much for your excellent attention. I hope that I've said something that's been helpful, though it's been a lot. Thank you very much.